Perfect.
One more.
Let's get started. This is the second half, but if you missed the first half, don't worry. It's a continuous theme, but a different focus. The theme I wanted to do this year was lighting up the darkness. Unfortunately, we're living in a difficult time right now in the world, as Jews, and I think just in general, I think people are feeling very confused, overwhelmed, and really not sure what's going on. The world is spinning at a pace probably we've never seen before. You open up, you read the news, and in just about any corner of the globe, there's something going on of significance. And how does it all tie together? I don't know, but it's a hard world to be living in, and we feel somewhat overcome by darkness. And I figure that using the holiday of Hanukkah, which is all about lighting a small candle, trying to illuminate the darkness in the room, and thereby symbolically lighting up the darkness of the world, I figured it would be a good opportunity to speak about it. So last week we talked about using the light of Torah, the light of a moral compass, to light up the world, to try to be the role models, to teach the world about right and wrong, to teach about the concepts of what we call Torah values, having morals. That was last week. But this week I wanted to look inward. And it's perhaps a more difficult topic. I think all of us can understand the concept from last week of where you have a religion and the job and the mission of the religion is to illuminate a path in life for the world. But what's perhaps more difficult is what happens when there's darkness within us. And you say, no, I'm generally a good person. There's not a lot of darkness. Well, the more honest we are with ourselves, the more we will come to understand that there is darkness within us. Maybe it's not evil. Maybe it's not darkness that we associate with barbarism and terrible, horrible, horrific kinds of activities, but there is darkness within us in the sense of that we are confused. We are sometimes, literally, as we use the expression, we're in the dark. We're not sure what to do. Is this right? Is this wrong? We seek sometimes what we need to do is to figure out a path that we can use the lights of Hanukkah, and we'll talk a little bit more about that, to overpower the darkness that veils our hearts and minds sometimes. We have to admit that within us resides light and darkness, virtue and vice, clarity, confusion, right and wrong. That does within us. We have flaws. We have things that were not perfect. I know, present company excluded, but for the most part, most of the world have flaws. I know. So you'll just teach the lesson to others because it doesn't apply to us. This is just theoretical. But we all have areas in which to improve. It's not a coincidence. I asked a teacher of mine, I was already post high school, and I asked my teacher after he had given a lesson that every single person has a certain mission in life to accomplish. This was the theme that he was talking about. How each one of us, God had a reason why I'm here. Because otherwise, why was I created? You can say it was a fluke, but the fact of the matter is that I'm here. I'm here for a reason. So his theme was that each one of us has a unique mission to fulfill. So I asked him the obvious question, right? I said to him, how are we supposed to know what we're supposed to do? None of us, to the best of my knowledge, was ever born with a little instruction manual or a little tag connected to the umbilical cord that said what it is we're supposed to accomplish in this world. So how are we supposed to know? His answer really struck a chord within me, and it made a big difference in my life. He said to me, if a person is honest with themselves, they're really willing to look at themselves honestly, they will see that they have certain strengths and that they have weaknesses. There are things that they are really good at. Naturally, it comes to them. And there are certain things that their nature is they have more of a leaning towards a certain negative trait. For example, certain people are very, very patient. They have a long, long fuse before they explode. And then there are people like me who it doesn't take much and I'm off the handle and it's just, I'm out there and it's just, I struggle with it. What he told me was, is that if a person looks at themselves and sees what those strengths are, it's more likely that's the area you should be focusing on because those are where your talents lie. Similarly, if you find yourself challenged with certain traits, or you find yourself drawn towards certain behaviors that are not proper, that's what you're here to correct. For God to put me in a position of where I'm supposed to be X, right? For example, let's say I'm supposed to be a plumber, and all of my expertise and all of my natural abilities are all regarding electricity. It's not a good match. Then I should be an electrician, not a plumber. Those are where my strengths lie. If I'm somebody who's naturally patient, right? Or vice versa, let's take it the other way, of where somebody like myself who's quick to get angry, well, then that's what I have to correct. Being charitable is a nice thing, but that's not where my focus needs to be. Still have to give my charity, but what is it that I should focus on? Focus on your strengths and weaknesses. That's what he told me. It was at that point that I switched. At that point, I was already almost done with my undergraduate degree in computer science. And I love computers. Liz can testify that when things go haywire in the office, the one they come calling is me. So fine. I can still have my handle in computers and dealing with networking and IT and all that stuff, but it's not my strength. My strength was the ability to articulate and to teach. So I switched. After I finished my undergrad, I switched to my master's in education. That's where I needed to be. Could I have done well in the computer world? Absolutely. I have no doubt. But that's not my essence. That's not who I am. So a person has to look within themselves and say, be honest, acknowledge I have strengths, but I also have weaknesses. I have a darkness within me that I need to correct. My flaws, whatever my inner demons may be, I have to learn to overcome and transcend those limitations so that I can reach my potential. If you think about it, that's really the concept of what it is we want to accomplish when we study Torah. And I'll tell you what I mean. Let me ask you a simple, simple question. Why do we know that the Torah, the written Torah, what we know as the Pentateuch, the five books of Moses, right? So the first book is called Bereshit, called Genesis, then is Exodus, then Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Those are the five books. There are 613 commandments comprised in all five, if you take the totality. But if you look at them much more specifically, you'll find that the first book, the book of Genesis, has only three commandments in it. The entire book is nothing more than stories. Stories starting with Adam and Eve and the creation of the universe, stories of Cain and Abel, the stories of Abraham and Sarah and their children, Isaac and Ishmael. Isaac marries Rebekah. They have their whole story. They don't have children for a while. Then they have twins, Jacob and Esau, and their sibling rivalry, and story after story until you get to the story of Joseph and his brothers and their jealousy, and they throw him in the pit, and he gets sold, and he goes to Egypt, interprets dreams. I mean, it's a fascinating novel. It's actually a bestseller. It's been a bestseller for 3,300 years. But anyway, right? But as far as do's and don'ts, who needs the first book of Genesis? Isn't that what the Torah is all about? If the Torah is here to teach me what's right and what's wrong, how my perspectives on life should be, then what are you telling me all these stories for? The answer that the sages teach us is that the entire purpose of, I shouldn't say it that way, a major purpose of the book of Genesis is to teach us practical examples of people's behaviors, their character. Some of them are positive characters. Some of them display negative traits. We need to learn, it's not an academic Oh, let's open up the book of morals and see. Oh, anger. Oh, that's a bad trait. Well, yes and no. Do you think it's cruel and wrong to go ahead and to wean off an addict and deny them their drug, their alcohol, whatever it is that they have an addiction to? And you just say, no, I'm not giving you any of it. If you were coming from another planet and you watch that behavior, you would label it as terribly cruel. This person wants something and you're denying them that? How wrong of you. That's so cruel. But we know that denying them that addiction is for their benefit. That's a good trait to have at that moment. Be tough. Don't give in to them. Oh, but be so kind, Rabbi. You always talk about this. Be kind. Be generous. Give people. If you do that, you're killing the person. So it's a matter of understanding practical examples. You have to appreciate the fact that character development is the foundation. And acquiring the do's and don'ts of a moral compass have to first be built on a solid foundation of character. I can go ahead and tell you, keep Shabbat, keep the Sabbath. Well, okay, maybe yeah, maybe no. Keep kosher. Well, okay, what if I don't have good character? And I'll be like, okay, when no one's looking, I'm not going to keep Shabbat. Or when no one's around, I'm not going to eat kosher. Okay, that's between you and God. But that's not the character we're talking about here. They tell an amazing story. Many of you have heard of a great Jewish philosopher. He was a very famous doctor known as Maimonides, the Rambam. Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon was what that acronym stands for. Rambam, four letters, are Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon. His father's name was Maimon. He was Moses ben Maimon. That was his name. And if that's where he got his name, Maimonides, because I-D-E-S as an ending of someone's name meant the son of. So Maimonides was the son of Maimon. That was where he got his name. Similarly, there was another fellow known as Nachmanides. He was the son of Nachman. That was where he got that name. When I was in high school and I acted up one too many times, my teacher would say to me, Tachmanides, please have a seat. Well, that was my name, Tachmanides. But the story goes that the Rambam, who was a great philosopher, he once had a tremendous debate with a non-Jewish philosopher about nature versus nurture. Famous debate, famous question, whether instinct or training was the decisive factor in animal behavior. So the other philosopher went ahead and he said, I will prove to you that it's all about training. The Rambam said, no, it's instinct. The guy says, no, I'll prove it to you. Give me 3 months. But 3 months later, they meet again. And this other philosopher goes ahead and he calls to the cat. And the cat comes out walking on two legs with a nice napkin over its paw. And it's delivering, you know, very much like a waiter coming in and serving the master. And everybody's, ooh, ah, look at that. You see, he trained him, animal behavior. The Rambam says, I'm not impressed. And he pulls out from behind him a mouse. And he puts the mouse down. And all of a sudden, the cat throws away the wine, throws off the napkin, jumps on all four and starts to pounce on the mouse. It's instinct. Humans have baser instincts. We are born with certain traits. Some of them are good. Some of them are not so good. We are born with those instincts and desires. But the difference between the cat or any other animal and a human being is that we have the ability to perfect those traits so we can control them. We can go ahead and say, you know what? I'm hungry. I have been fasting for many, many hours. But today is Yom Kippur. It's a fast day. I'm not going to be eating on my Day of Atonement. We have the ability. If you starve your dog You starve your pet for even 6, 8, 10 hours. And you put food out in front and you say, but you can't, you have to wait until sunset till we break fast. Good luck with that. Instinct will take over. When it comes to a human being, we have the ability to rise above that. What's fascinating is there is not one single mitzvah, not one commandment in the Torah that tells us to improve our character. There is no such mitzvah. Which, if you think about it, is shocking. You would think that there would be many such mitzvot. You want the Torah to teach us about improving our character, developing our character, improving, trying to make ourselves better. There is no specific commandment to improve our character. Why? Because it's the very foundation of the Torah. It's a prerequisite. I'll ask you a simple question, and I'll give you a chance to respond. I won't even give you the answer right away. We all know how Abraham, our patriarch Abraham, he turned the world upside down because he introduced this concept of monotheism to the world. He and his wife, Sarah, they really tremendous, tremendous visionaries and went out to accomplish what they did. But we know his story, their story, doesn't start till much, much later in their life. They don't have Yitzchak, Isaac, until they're, as the Torah says, he's 100 and she's 90 years old. 190. He's 100, she's 90 years old. That's quite old. And yes, you can tell me they lived longer back then. Fine. Do the mathematics and you'll see. So he's 70 and she's 60. Woohoo! Okay, it's still quite, they're not spring chickens. What do we know about his early life? What do we read about in the Torah itself? Very little. Very little. The first time we're introduced after he's born, which is a passing reference to who his father, and he had X number of children by name. The next thing we're told, really the first piece, is that God comes to him and tells him, I need you to leave and go on this journey away from your home, away from your homeland, and go out on this journey. Lech lecha. Go. How old is he at that point? Anybody? Take a wild guess.
70?
Very close, Robin. 75.
Oh, somebody here said 75.
75 years of age.
Yeah, there we go. We got it. Okay.
75 years of age, and now we're told the story. He goes on his journey, and they have to go down to Egypt, and Sarah's taken, and you go on from there. What do we know about the first 75 years of his life? What happened? Alan, is that not shocking to you? This is the patriarch who starts the whole thing. It's surprising. We're not told about his biography, his background. What the heck did he do for 75 years? And the truth of the matter is, if you examine it more closely, we really don't know much about him until really 90, 99 actually. That's really where all the action begins. So what did he do for the first 99 years of his life? The Torah is very quiet about it. Strange. I've read many books in my life. My mom would be so proud because for years I refused to read any books. I wasn't very interested. And then I got into Robert Ludlum and I read all of those and that just got me going. He builds up in the first numerous chapters. He weaves together information, background, so you get the character and what they're all about. And yeah, our book starts with Abraham, 99 years old. He's given a command to now circumcise himself because he's going to become the father of our nation. And we're supposed to just, okay, great. What's his background? Did anyone do an FBI background check on this guy? Like, is he legit? We don't know much about him. The commentaries tell us that what is relevant to us, remember, the Torah is not meant to be a history book. It's not what it is. Because if it is, it's terrible. It's a horrible history book. It jumps from thing to thing, doesn't always go in chronological order, and there's major gaps. It's not meant to be a history book. That's not what it's all about. Rather, the Torah is here to give us guidance. What is relevant and important for me thousands of years later that I can that I can implement and put into practice in my own life. If it was not relevant, what he did the first 50 years of his life, then the Torah does not need to record it because it's not relevant. There's nothing I'm going to learn from it. Now, it's true. There's a lot of Judaic literature known as the Talmud, the Midrash, many other sources that flesh out a lot of these early years. But the Torah itself, the five books of Moses, does not give us that information. What did he do? So the commentaries tell us that he spent his entire life before God came to him and really started this path of godliness and spirituality in the world. He was perfecting himself, becoming a good person. That's it. He was working on himself as an individual, as a, what are his character traits? Working on being patient, working on being charitable, working on being hospitable, working on all these traits. That's what he spent his time doing. Watch what happens. The entire book of Genesis, the entire first book of the Torah, is a book of modeled behaviors. Good and not so good. But what we want to see is those traits in practice up close. You know what I love most about the Torah? This is the favorite thing about the Torah in my eyes. It's real. There are no such things as our leaders without warts. There's no such thing as the perfect person. As great as we hold up Abraham and Sarah and all of the other matriarchs and patriarchs, they had flaws. Moses was not perfect. Yes, greatest prophet that ever lived, but fallible? Yes. And the Torah is not afraid to point it out because then I can relate to the person. You see, sometimes you read biographies of these people and you're like, that's amazing, but that's never going to be me. Oh, this kid, when he was already 5 years old, he was already a genius. He was already reciting, you know, all the presidents backwards and forwards and tell you all the dates. Forget it. I can't relate to this guy. It's just out of my league. But you open up a Torah and you see the greatness of Avram and you see a mistake. And you see the greatness of Sarah and you see her laugh when she shouldn't have laughed. These are normal, regular people. The entire book of Bereshit, the entire book of Genesis is there to show us character, both positive and negative. This idea, the Talmud tells us that Derech Eretz Kadma LaTorah, refinement of character precedes Torah wisdom. Before you open up the book and you start studying the laws, the do's and the don'ts, you have to be a person who's working on their character, who's trying to overcome the flaws that we are, the baser instincts that we are born with. If it remains an academic pursuit, and this is really the key phrase here, the word Torah means what? Literal translation of the word Torah does not mean Bible. That is not the correct translation. The word Torah means guidance. That's really what it means, to guide. A teacher in Hebrew is called a mora. A mora. Mora, Torah. It's the same root word because it's the one who provides the education, the one who provides the guidance. Torah is meant to provide guidance on how we become better people, not as an academic pursuit. I share with you a very scary statistic. It's not pleasurable, but it is a fact. If you have intellect, if you have wisdom, but you lack proper character, it will lead to even greater destruction. And I'll cite you the statistic. 9 out of the 13 participants at the Wannsee Conference, where they formulated in Nazi Germany the final solution for the extermination of European Jewry, 9 of those 13 participants had PhDs. 44% of the SS Guard, which were the elite group but they were the most criminal, the most cruel. 44% of the SS Guard had PhDs. If it remains just intellectual concepts, intellectual academic wisdom, that does not preclude it from becoming destructive forces. Because you can have wisdom, but have horrible character traits, and you will use the wisdom in a negative manner. Wisdom does not mean you're a good person. Character defines the person. That is the honest truth. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, the one who is now famous for starting what is now known as the Musar movement. Anybody know what this word Musar means? Musar is character development. He formulated an entire study in all the Jewish institutions teaching about character and ethical refinement. He said, trying to repair one bad character trait is more difficult than learning the entire Talmud, because you have to dig deep within yourself and try to change your behaviors. That is what we are going to focus on for tonight. This idea that we have to look within ourselves because we have traits that need to be improved. That's what we have to focus on. How many mitzvos are there in the Torah? How many commandments? We all know, 613. 613. If I told you the following, think of it this way. If the Torah here is the Torah is the book that's supposed to give me guidance on how to be a better person, improving my character, that means the commandments in the book are the mechanisms targeting specific traits to improve. Would that come to you as a surprise? I would hope not. If the totality of the Torah is to make me a refined ethical person, that's the objective, then the mitzvos are the targeted traits, right? The targeted activities to improve the traits. How many positive commandments and how many negative commandments in the Torah?
365 and 248.
Excellent, Larry. That is correct. Do you know why that is?
The sinews in the body and the connective tissues.
There you go. And that is exactly right. There are 248 limbs, so to say, in the body, and 365 sinews, pathways in the person. It is a perfect one-to-one correspondence. The mitzvot connect directly. The positive commandments and the negative commandments are targeting the full head-to-toe person. So the fulfillment of the commandments in the Torah is the fulfillment to turn you into the most refined character as a person. I want to tell you an amazing story. You say, that takes a lifetime of work and nobody can get it right. Listen to this story. It's a famous story. Some of you may have heard this. They tell a story at there's an organization. It started in New York. It's known as HASC. And it's now a camp, and it's also a school that's targeted specifically for children with special needs. They're either somewhere on the spectrum, or they have learning disabilities, Down syndrome, but they have special needs. It's an amazing thing. For those of us living in Baltimore, we have a school very similar known as Jules. My mother actually teaches there. It's an amazing thing. Anyway, the story goes that there are children playing in a park. They were playing baseball, playing softball, and they chose teams, and they're having a great time, and everybody's great. And comes along this boy, his name was Shia. Shia, short for Isaiah, Shia. Long story short, he wants to play. His father asked the boys if they would choose him, you know, to be part of it. Now, clearly, he's the kind of guy like me who ended up playing right field because, you know, you don't want him messing up too badly. So you put him out somewhere in right field, you know, once in a blue moon, maybe the ball will get there and the center fielder will get it anyway. Okay, that was the position. Sometimes I played right field, sometimes I played left out. But which either way, that's how it worked. Okay? So fine. So one of the teams said, okay, we'll pick Shia. Okay, fine, he's out there. Now you have to put him in the batting order also. Can't skip him. It's not nice. So where would you put him? You put him last. You put him last like everything else. Okay, fine. Fast forward the whole story. It's a close game. Bottom of the ninth. Two outs. And of course, they're down by one run. And there's a runner on base. And of course, who's up? Shai is up. And of course, you can see the captain of the team is like, ah, no, we're going to do it. It's the right thing to do. So sure enough, Shai gets up there, can't hold the bat. So one of the players from his team walks up, gets the acknowledgement from the opposing pitcher that he'll help him hold the bat. The opposing pitcher looks at him and he takes two steps forward, comes a little closer. And he lobs it in like a meatball over the middle of the plate. And Shia swings and he misses. The opposing pitcher takes another two steps closer and lobs it as slowly as he can. And sure enough, together with his friend's help, he gives a little hit and it dribbles. It dribbles down the third baseline. An easy play for the third baseman. Throw him out at first. Game over. They win. The third baseman takes it, and he, again, you can see them communicating with their eyes. He takes it, and he throws it 100 miles over the head of the first baseman, and it goes way out, and the right fielder grabs it, and everybody's screaming, run, Shia, run! And he runs, you know, to first base, and at this point, the right fielder takes it, and he throws it, and it goes way over the second. Okay, anyway. Long story, you can figure out the ending. Sure enough, by the time he's rounding third and he's coming home for the winning run, both teams, all 18 players are there walking and cheering behind him. And when he touches home plate, they all lift him up and they scream, Shia, you won the game. The father told this story. Shia's father told this story at the school's dinner. And he told it, and of course, tears, there wasn't a dry eye in the house. And he said, you don't understand. Shia, he felt like $1 million, but it was over and done with. But the impression that it made on everybody, what refined character these boys were. They understood that it was just a game, but how you can lift a person up. How you can elevate the person to such an extent that the game was so insignificant and they made Shia feel like $1 million. That's the greatness that lies within us. If we're willing to be honest with ourselves and to look within ourselves to become better. If you think about it, it makes perfect sense. The very beginning of the Torah, it tells us about the creation of the first man and woman, of Adam and Eve. And it tells us that God created them, B'Tselem Elokim, in the image of God. That's a strange expression. Whose image exactly is, you know, which one of us is reflecting God's image? Does God look like me? Heaven forbid, right? What does it mean in the image of God? What does that mean? So we all know the answer. That means God invested within each one of us that godliness. We can reflect godliness in this world. When we go ahead and we behave a certain way that reflects positively, it's a reflection of God. And God forbid the other way around. If we do something, it reflects negatively about God. I had the story. I learned it from another story, but I started doing it myself. I had read a story years ago. I used to travel when I used to go from Baltimore, my parents lived in New York, up in upstate New York, and I would travel the Garden State Parkway. And if you, those of you who've traveled on that road years ago, it literally every 2.5 miles was another toll booth. And it was a stinking, well, at the time, 25 cents, and it went to 35 cents. But it was a royal pain in the neck before Easy Pass. And I remember reading a story about a great rabbi who lived in New Jersey. That when it came time for him to go through a toll, he had two options, to go through the machine and just put in the money, or to go actually to the toll collector, a person. And I don't know about you, but more often than not, I would rather just go through the machine. It's quicker. You don't have to deal with it. He told his driver, I want you to go specifically to the toll collector. Okay. Sure enough, pulls up to the toll collector, pays the toll, says thank you, and keeps going. The driver turns to his rabbi and he says, why? Like, what's the difference? I mean, it's the same 35 cents and it's, you know, quicker. The rabbi told him the following. He said, think about it for a moment. Let's put yourself in the shoes of the toll collector. You're on some highway and it's late at night. There aren't that many cars. And finally, there's a car coming and it's coming towards your lane. And at the last second, it goes and it chooses the machine over the human being. How do you think the guy feels? So you say, oh, he doesn't care. He's just getting paid. He's just there to help. But there's a certain part of him that says, what am I doing with my life? A machine can do what I can do. Yeah, for the one schmagegi who doesn't have change, all right, fine. I'll be the guy. But if you go ahead, I want you to go to the guy who's a person and say good evening. Say thank you. See if you can catch his name. Give him a little respect. Show him a little something, dignity.
Yep.
I read that story and I started doing it. Unless it was a long line and then I wasn't such a righteous guy. Okay. But I would try to do that. And I remember traveling. We had, I don't know, my oldest was probably only, I don't know, a year and 2 years, maybe 2 years old. And we're traveling and it was late at night and she had fallen asleep in the back seat. And it happened to be that I went through the machine part and I literally just, you know, I knew how to go through it at 15 miles an hour. Didn't have to stop. Just threw in the change. Ding, boom, ready to go. And as soon as I pass through, I hear from the back, Abba, you didn't say thank you. I said, what? Yeah, because she had heard many times at that point already, I would go through and I would say thank you to the, but that's what it is. If you can learn to change your behavior, you become more in tune with the sensitivities of others. That's what it's all about. We are reflecting that godliness. So let's talk about certain traits, and then I want to share one other, because we got to tie it back to Hanukkah, obviously. Are there some traits that are good and others that are bad? What would you say? Rhett, what do you think? Are there certain traits that are just good and certain traits that are just bad? What would you say?
I guess.
What's a good trait?
Well, a good trait is something that you do something good.
Good. Something positive. Can you name me a kind of trait that you would classify as good? It's a good trait.
Doing a mitzvah.
Like, give me an example. Give me something. What's a good trait that you have? I can think of one. You're always so positive. You're smiling.
Yeah.
Positive energy about yourself. Right?
Yeah.
That's a good trait.
Oh, okay.
Right? You would think so.
Yeah.
Okay. What's a bad trait?
Not showing the energy.
Okay. Can you name me, like, what's a good, Michelle, what's a bad trait?
Greed.
Greed. Lust. Anger. Right? Those we would classify as bad traits. Hospitality. Kind. Caring, sensitive, positive, you know, those are good traits and those are bad traits. You know how you say character traits in Hebrew? Anybody know? It's a great word. What is it, Liz? I think you're mouthing it.
Midos?
Yes, Midos, Middos, or Midot if you say it in Hebrew. Midos. Do you know what the literal translation of midos are? It does not mean character traits. That's a borrowed term. The literal translation means measurements. Hmm. You're like, okay, that's weird. Why would the word for character traits be measurements? The answer is very simple. And that is every single trait. There is nothing that is totally good and nothing that is totally evil and bad. It has to be measured appropriately. I give you the example we said before. my cruel action of denying someone what they want, what they say they need, that actually could be a very good trait if the person's an addict. If Rhett wants to use his positive trait of always smiling and giving that positive instruction, that's going to make it very hard when his kid does something really bad and he has to show at least externally a little rough, a little displeasure. If you smile at the kid and say, "That was terrible. How could you do that?" And you smile through the whole thing, it's not going to work. So every single trait, even quote unquote bad traits, is there ever a time to show anger? Yeah, yes, there is. There are times where you have to show. Now, does it have to be a deep-seated, real anger that's coming as a wellspring of true anger and revenge? Not necessarily. But certainly an external display of anger is in order sometimes. There is no trait that is completely good or completely bad. It has to be measured. This word midos or midah in the singular is used when describing clothing. The Kohens, right? The Kohen, the priests that would work in the temple, they had to wear special priestly garments. The regular Kohen and the high priest, of course. The way the Torah describes it is that the clothes had to be midah. It had to be measured, tailor-made. It had to be tailor-fit. And there's a great parallel. The parallel between the physical garments which clothe the body and the physical body which clothes the soul. Just like the body to the contour is detected by its clothing, you can tell the shape of the person by their clothing, so too the midos and the character traits of the soul can be detected by the way the person behaves. That gives you an indication. It's the same root word for garment and midos. They both mean measured. So there are certain traits that we have to work on, but we have to learn to become consistent inside and out. We all know that the most holy vessel in the temple was what? What was the holiest vessel in the temple or in the tabernacle?
Ark.
The ark, the Aron, the ark itself. It was made of what, Larry? What material?
Was it gold-clad wood?
Very good.
Stone?
It was three boxes, one within the other. The innermost was plated with gold. The outermost one was also plated with gold. In between, it stayed wood. But it was gold on the inside, gold on the outside. The Talmud wants to know why. Why would it be plated that way? Especially the inside one. Who cares? No one ever saw it. Just if it's all about the external show. No, the Talmud says it's to teach us the inner essence has to be in consonance with the outward appearance. It has to be gold inside and out, because that's ultimately what the Torah wants to teach us. We need to be gold on the inside as well as the outside. We've all met people where it's a superficial show. They have a certain public persona. They come across as this or that. And then once they close the door at home, it's like Jekyll and Hyde, a whole different person. That's not what the Torah is teaching us to be. We need to strive for that symmetry between the essence and the image portrayed, projected. Notice that the Torah never says to be perfect inside and out. That's not a possibility. That's not what the Torah expects of us. We have imperfections. Don't make believe that they're not there. You have to accept them and then strive to improve. The Aron, the Ark, was not made completely of gold, because that's the reality of living in our physical world. We are not perfect. Impossible to be only spiritual. We live in the physical world. And perhaps that's why the middle one remains wood. Wood is a natural product. Wood is natural. Natural material that grows from the ground. But what's amazing about it is that the natural world grows. It develops. It's not stagnant. How did this become wood? It grew into a tree, but it started as a small sapling. It grew. It developed. The lesson is that we need to sanctify ourselves and using as the vehicle to reach the great spiritual heights. Gold on the outside has to be reflecting the true gold on the inside. In between is all about growth. That's why it's wood. Let's talk about how important this idea of consistency is. I know I spoke about this once upon a time, but maybe you will have forgotten as well as I did when I did. We're reading now in the Torah portions of the week. We're now reading the story of Joseph and his brothers. And God willing, we're going to get to, not this week, but next week, we're going to have the fateful moment of where Joseph reveals his identity. He says, Ani Yosef, I am Joseph. Ha'od Avichai. Is my father still alive? He asks the brothers. He can no longer contain himself and he has to reveal his identity. But he asks the question that was burning on his mind. Is my father still alive? He hasn't seen his father in 22 years. Seems like a very natural question that he'd want an answer to. However, Rashi, the great commentator, quotes from the early sources that tells us that the brothers felt, rightfully so, rebuked. They felt rebuked by Yosef. And the Talmud and the Midrash actually says that if Joseph, who was one of the youngest brothers, rebuked his brothers and they had no response, they were so shocked by the information, oy vey, woe is it to us when we stand before God after 120 years and God rebukes us, what are we going to say? Now, it's a beautiful lesson, but on the surface, where's there any rebuke? Joseph just said his identity and asked an important question. I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? But if you recall, what triggered his now sharing his identity? What story took place? One of his brothers, Judah, stepped up to the plate. And Judah makes an impassionate plea with him. Don't keep Benjamin. Benjamin had just been framed for stealing something from Joseph's house, from the viceroy's. He didn't know it was Joseph. Joseph had planted the beautiful goblet and he put it in Benjamin's sack and he sent the brothers back towards Canaan to go bring back food because there was a famine. And then he sends his horsemen to go bring Benjamin back and he wants to imprison him and say, no, I'm going to keep Benjamin as a slave. The rest of you can go home. And Judah says, no, I can't let you do that. I will be happy to switch places with Benjamin. Why do you want to switch places, Judah? Let Benjamin pay the price. He's the one who committed the crime. And Judah tells the story that if Benjamin doesn't come home, my dad is going to die a broken man because Benjamin is only one of two children from his favorite wife, Rachel. And Rachel already passed away in childbirth. Joseph is gone, and dad made me swear that I would bring Benjamin back. Under no circumstances was he to be left behind. Oh, what's going to be with my father? My father is so connected to Benjamin. I can't let him. And he goes on and on and on about the detrimental effect that it's going to have on Jacob, the father. And Joseph can contain himself no longer. And he says, Ani Yosef, I am Joseph. Is dad still alive? What kind of question is that? Judah just spent the last 20 minutes telling him a whole sob story about the effect it's going to have on their father. What do you mean, is my father still alive? Yeah, I just told you that. The sages tell us there's another way to read this comment of Joseph. It's not a question. It's a statement of fact. Ani Yosef, I am Joseph. Is dad still alive? Rhetorical? Really? Now all of a sudden you come and you come plead the case of please have mercy on this young child, Benjamin. Why? Because it's going to have such a terrible negative effect on our father, Jacob. Oh, he's going to be heartbroken to lose a child. Joseph hears this and he says, hey, I'm Joseph. Remember me? 22 years ago, you didn't give a flying flamingo about the effect it was going to have on Dad. Really? You sold me. You got rid of me. How come when it was convenient for you, you were willing to say, don't worry about Dad. We'll tell him some bubamaisa. We'll tell him some story that he was devoured by an animal and da-da-da-da-da. What about his heartbreak? Nah, this is more important. We got to get rid of Joseph. Now you're a hypocrite. You're inconsistent. Now you come to me and you say, oh, we have to take into consideration the effect Benjamin's loss is going to have on Jacob. Ani Yosef. I'm Joseph. Ha'od avichai! Exclamation point. Not question. It's not an informational question. He knows he's alive. But he's pointing out the hypocrisy, the inconsistency. What the Torah asks of us is to work on ourselves that we are consistent. If we subscribe to the ideals of values, of patience, honesty, integrity, whatever these traits that we're supposed to work on, not rationalizing things, then it has to be consistent. We can't just talk a good game. We have to walk it too. We have to be consistent. Consistency is the absolute name of the game. So now we come to the holiday of Hanukkah. The holiday of Hanukkah. And we light a candle. And as we said last week, the idea of lighting the candle, we wait until it's nightfall, specifically when it's dark outside. And we shine a light because we want to illuminate the world. We want to bring a sense of clarity. Remember, we spoke about that last week. Clarity of what's right and wrong. We want to bring that to the world. Perhaps for this week, we can also say that it's time we shine a light inside ourselves with an honest look. An honest look. It's easy to point out the flaws and to see all the negative things of others. But how often do we look in the mirror honestly and say, I really do need to work on this. I really need to have this. I'm convinced, I really am, that the people who are the quickest to point out flaws in others themselves are challenged with that exact issue. Why do I say that? Because it's so in the forefront of their minds, because they are grappling with it, that it becomes a cinch to see it in others. Because it's right there in front of them. Haman, I know I'm mixing up my holidays, but Haman in the story of Purim is so quick to point out to Ahasuerus why he should destroy the Jews. Because he says the Jewish people, they're scattered and dispersed amongst all the other countries in your empire. Haman is very sensitive to the idea of creating a wedge, of where there's dispersion, there's disunity amongst people. Why do I say that? Because Haman comes from what nation? Amalek. Amalek, we know from the story in the Torah, Amalek is the nation that ambushed us on the way out of Egypt and tried to build a wedge between those that were straggling in the back and those that were part of the nation. Tried to put a wedge, having disunity between the Jewish people and God. That's in his DNA. That's his character flaw. So what does he find at fault as the Jewish people? That exact trait. This is what we need to do. Hanukkah comes along and it says, light a candle, not just to illuminate outside, but it's time to shine a light inside and to see the character traits that we have, both good and bad, and to work on them to the point of where that we become consistent inside and out. I'll finish with this. I quoted, I'll be honest, up until this was all mine, but I was so tempted. I wanted to see what ChatGPT would come up with if I put in a couple of keywords. I won't read you the whole thing. It's not bad. It really isn't. But here's the ending. I thought it was so perfect. As we immerse ourselves in the wisdom of the Torah. Let us internalize its lessons, allowing them to penetrate our beings and guide our actions. Let us become beacons of kindness, compassion, and righteousness, spreading the light we have gained to dispel the shadows in the world around us and within ourselves. Man, I couldn't have written that any better. I thought it was fascinating that it can come up with that. This is the lesson I think that we can all connect with. Comes this holiday of Hanukkah and it bangs home this message of shining the light inside, because we have to work on ourselves. I can't really change the world until I start with myself. That we all know that. I'm not telling you anything new and novel, but that's the message here of being able to be consistent, working on ourselves to improve our character. And we can rationalize it from now until who knows when. But if we're really honest with ourselves, we realize that we have traits that need to be improved. And I'll finish with this. One last thing. If I were to say to you, name the most important principle in the Torah, most of you would say, love your fellow like yourself, right? We've all heard that before. The Ahavta L'Reacha Kamocha. However, most people don't finish the sentence. Do you know there are two more words? You're all looking at me like, really? The verse says, you shall love your fellow like yourself. Come two more Hebrew words. Ani Hashem. I am God. Okay. You can have that on every verse. Why is it specifically here? Why specifically on this verse does it have I am Hashem? So the truth is you have to break down this sentence into three parts. And what you'll see is that there's three ideals. One is my relationship to others. Love your fellow. Character refinement in terms of my relationship, interpersonal relationships with others. But it says love your fellow like yourself. That's your relationship with yourself, looking within yourself to improve. And how am I supposed to know what's right and what's wrong? Ani Hashem. I am God who can be the role model to teach you, give you the guidance on how best to improve your character so that it will be beneficial both for improving yourself and your relationship with others and your relationship with God. All three are in that verse. That's my message for you tonight. We want to light up the darkness. We start with ourselves. Pick one trait. Be honest with yourself. Each one of us has to pick what's for us. Pick a trait that you're going to work on and say, you know what? This winter, that's what I'm going to work on. Between Hanukkah and Purim. How's that? It's only a couple of months. This is the trait I'm going to work on. Whatever it is. If you have trouble, you don't know any traits that you can work on, call me. I'll find one for you. No problem. That's easy. I'm easy. Pointing that out, that's easy. But if we look at ourselves and say, what can I improve on? And we work on it, then we can look back now on Hanukkah and say, I got the message. I learned the lesson about lighting up the darkness within myself so that I can make the world a better place. If we can do that, we're well on our way. Any thoughts, comments, ideas that anybody wants to share? Questions? Come on, Robin, you always have something for me.
I'm thinking about it. I'm working on it. Not right now. I'm just taking it in.
You don't have to. Usually, you're
why?
Like,
yeah.
Why can't we do a eulogy over Hanukkah?
Because it's a festive. It's a festive days. When you have, like, we don't do eulogies on Shabbat. We don't do eulogies on the holidays. Hanukkah is considered a festive day. We don't do actual eulogies. There are many opinions that say you're not even allowed to fast. If a person has a custom, they fast. You can't do it on Hanukkah. Can't do it on Hanukkah. It's considered one of those festive days. We sing the special songs of Hallel. Hallel is, you know, taken from Psalms. It's all 8 days. We sing the full chapters of Hallel. It's a very festive holiday. Well, I don't know about you, Larry, but I eat like it's a festive holiday for 8 days. And Lord, oh Lord, man, oh man, as they say, Manischewitz. Woo! Any other ideas? Any thoughts? Okay. Wonderful. Thank you for joining me. Have a great rest of Hanukkah. Great to have you. Always a pleasure.
Hey, put in a pitch for tomorrow night.
Yes, tomorrow night, for those who are interested, I actually will be in Frederick. Normally, our Wednesday night class is on Zoom. But this week, because of Hanukkah, I'm going to bring special treats. We're going to play some games, have a little learning. You're welcome to join us. It'll be Beth Shalom in Frederick, 1011 North Market Street at 8 p.m. If you cannot make it, don't worry. It's still on Zoom. We'll still have it. But we'd love to see you. And by all means, spread the word. All right. Have a great rest of the week, everybody. If I don't speak to you beforehand and I don't see you, have a great Shabbos, and we'll see you next time.